think we should start. Going to have a discussion, an educational session on dynamic risk management, and the floor to Ross.
Thank you very much, Hans. Today we'll continue the education sessions as we laid out in the plan previously. Today we're going to focus on the D in DRM, more specifically, what events will give rise to a change in a portfolio, how management would react to those changes, and then overall, what does the dynamic nature of the portfolio mean when thinking about repricing of NIM and managing of repricing risk. On pages 4 through 6, I've quickly summarized what we discussed in May. I'll touch upon it very briefly. But we've talked about how DRM is focusing on NIM and managing how NIM reprices over time. Debt-funded portfolios, assuming the objective is long-run stability, that involves aligning the repricing of assets and those liabilities. However, the fact that significant amounts of the banking book is funded with core deposits, this creates a problem, as those core deposits do not reprice over time, making it theoretically impossible to align the repricing of an asset which must reprice with a core deposit which will never reprice. As such, when we're talking about deposit-funded portfolios, DRM focuses on managing NIM, how it will reprice. However, a decision must be made from management's perspective as to how that repricing will take place. So it's more a conversation around an asset profile and how managing that asset profile rather than a strict alignment question. If there are any questions throughout the presentation, please stop me as I go along, and I'll answer them.
That's a bit quick, Mary.
Oh, I had one, and it may just be a wording thing, but with dynamic risk management, I always worry that when I'm losing my grasp, what's going on. On slide 4, and you describe here DRM as an attempt to stabilize changes. Do you mean to stabilize changes or to stabilize NIM itself? Because if it's just wording, don't worry about it. But I just wondered if there's something deeper there that you're trying
to. No,
it's
really meant to stabilize NIM.
Okay.
I think you could read into stabilizing changes and the fact that we're accepting that NIM must change over time.
Okay.
So I want to stabilize how that change occurs. But I think calling it stabilization of NIM is fine.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll go to slide 7. So the scope of dynamic risk management is often the entire banking book, which comprises, generally speaking, the retail and commercial aspects of banks. We'll exclude the capital markets arm of those institutions. And since you're talking about retails, you're going to have frequent changes in the portfolio. New loans will be originated, new deposits will be originated. And those changes are going to happen very often. In theory, they're going to happen daily. It might not necessarily be real time. So since the portfolio is changing often, the comparison of this target profile we've talked about and the actual asset profile, that comparison is updated often to make sure that there is alignment between the target and the actual. Since that comparison is updated often, the mitigating actions are updated often, which can lead to a significant amount of derivative activity if you accept that derivatives are the most commonly used instrument from that perspective. So in an attempt to talk about this in a structured manner, I'm going to try and break down those changes in the portfolios into events and try and put a little bit of a wall around it. So I'm going to focus on 4 main types of events that can impact the portfolio: product maturity, product growth, concept of time. I appreciate that's not an event, but just grant me that for a moment, and then prepayment. Prepayment will be discussed in a separate session. We will not discuss it today. So on slide 9, we'll just start to discuss product maturity. So if you accept that DRM is trying to align the repricing of assets and liabilities, and the repricing of those asset liabilities will take place generally at maturity, the portfolio, when it's evaluated and measured, already considers the maturity of products. You think about, and kind of the case studies we walked through, and case study 1 is reproduced here, we looked at assets that were going to mature over a 5-year horizon, but that was taken into account when thinking about the mitigating actions that were required. So having said that, when you have a maturity of a product, it's not necessarily a an unexpected change to the portfolio. It is something that's expected to occur. As long as it occurs as anticipated, this is really a non-event for the dynamic risk management. Case study one demonstrated this in May, and perhaps it wasn't explicitly the main focus of that case, but that was illustrated there. The more subtle points that we made in that case study was that sometimes the profile will assume a reinvestment of a product. And so we had a 10-year profile in that case, but we had 5-year assets. But we talked about how, well, that just means there are certain actions required at T5. So if the profile assumes a reinvestment of the product, we discussed in that case, well, that's not a problem. As long as the hedging markets are open, that change in the portfolio is expected and can be managed. If the product maturity happens at the end of the profile, so back in case study one, that was the end of T10, that's the repricing profile that was determined to be appropriate for the institution. So overall theme here around product maturity is that it's not really much to talk about from a dynamic risk management perspective. It's expected to occur. If it happens as it occurs, that's good. And kind of the process moves on. Pause there. On slide 11, we start to talk about growth.
Sorry, can I just check the implication of what you said about in slide 9? If it happens as expected, it's not a problem for DRM. The implication is if it happens not as expected, then that's something that requires DRM to respond. I assume that part of that discussion we'll have in another meeting when you talk about prepayments.
Yes.
And is prepayments really the only driver of maturities not happening when you expect?
The other item would be kind of a credit event.
Okay.
But yes.
But that's presumably outside of DRM because that's managed as credit. Okay.
Yes.
So this really is C prepayments.
Yes.
Okay.
It's not what you're managing per se.
Correct.
The credit defaults.
That's right.
Just for the rest, what Sue was asking is that it will happen and those are the other cases we are going to talk about with time and other things, and you'll have to manage that. But those prepayments is the big one where it is not as per the expectation of the profile, as you pointed out.
Okay. That was kind of the implication of this, that because you kept saying if it happens as expected, it's not an issue, doesn't require a response from DRM. And I just wanted to check that means C prepayments.
You were correctly interpreting my words.
Or we can call it an early liquidation, not to confuse with the discussion we are having the prepayment.
Don't worry, Amara. I'm going to be very careful that doesn't happen. We are not discussing prepayments in July.
I will not mention the word prepayment again. So product, page 11, product growth. I'll talk about two forms of growth here just to highlight a subtle point that I think is obvious, but I just want to make sure it's clear. Talk about growth funded by deposits and then growth funded by debt. Just to take another step back, when I say growth, not all origination is growth. Origination can just be the replacement of a mature product. Growth means an increase in the total balance that's applicable there. So it would be kind of originations net of maturities equals growth. So that's when we talk about growth, that's how we're using the phrase. So I'll start on slide 13 here. My idea for case studies and our learning are useful. The exciting learning will come on page 15, so bear with me for two slides. So we have a boring bank here, ABC Bank, that has nothing but fixed rate loans funded by core deposits. The loans are around for 5 years. And core deposits are going to be around into perpetuity. Management is comfortable with that assessment. On slide 14, the bank has decided they would like a different repricing profile than 100% after 5 years. They would like it to be 50% 3 years, 50% 5 years, the decision they have made. They execute the necessary derivatives to transform that portfolio. So this is, we have $1,000 of loans, and I only want effectively $500 of five-year loans. I have a 500 five-year pay-fix swap, and then a 500 three-year receive-fix swap, and that will match the profile here. Comparing my asset profile, the combination of loans, derivatives, and the float legs against my target profile below. So making it more easy, if I start with the target profile that I want, 503 and 505, I have my loans and I have my derivatives, which get me there.
I may be forgetting some of my lessons from last month's meeting on this. And this is a question about how these instruments work, the derivative instruments work, rather than great theories behind it. So you say you put in place a 5-year pay fix, so presumably you pay fixed and receive
float.
Float, okay? And you do that for 5 years?
Yes.
Okay, so that's instrument one, and then instrument two is receive fixed, 3 years pay float. Okay. And because I was looking at this and trying to match up the mismatch in durations on these two and saying, would people really enter into an agreement where after X period of time there's just one leg? What you're saying is no, each of these boxes has two legs, but the net effect of them is the duration transformation.
Correct.
Okay.
Fair question, Bishop.
I think it's one of those cases where Gro's presentation might be helpful.
We should.
I can do that. So on slide 15.
Sorry. On the fourth page, slide 14, you said NIM is 5.5.
Yes.
Could you explain
please
how?
Please reconcile.
The previously you're kind to show how those numbers are derived, but at this time you skipped every calculation.
Your students are not that advanced.
Sorry. Okay, then later on, it's okay.
I'm happy to do it later.
Just give us a separate document.
I have quadruple checked my math, and okay. I'm comfortable it is 5.5.
Another thing, just minor thing, as maybe there is. So we are not ignoring the kind of cost of hedging, well, cost of derivatives. So we ignore. Because we are introducing different style of derivatives previously. You know.
We'll have to talk about the cost of hedging
okay.
at some point. As an editorial comment, when we're talking about interest rate swaps, as we're discussing here, the cost of those derivatives is very, very small in most liquid markets. Fractions of basis points, fractions of a point of a percentage point. That doesn't mean we can't acknowledge it, but it's perhaps not a material aspect of the story.
Generally, when we are doing Chengdu, fair question, and you'll see this coming up with the cost of hedging when it comes in, when we start. I have to use a word which Ross said we shouldn't, prepayments, because then you bring in options. They have a major cost. Swaps are usually transacted for almost zero fair value, as we say at initial recognition.
Can I ask another question about 14? I was trying to do kind of little debits and credits, to do the gross up of the swap. And if you've entered into a pay fix for 5 years after the offset expires at the end of 3 years, haven't you transformed half of your asset portfolio into a variable rate instrument?
So after going back to case study one, at the end of T3 in this example,
mm-hmm.
we're going to have, effectively assuming no other changes in the portfolio, half of the portfolio will now reprice because I'm going to have to make a decision as to what I do with that 500 loan or that 500 swap that has just matured.
Right. Well, the swap has matured, so it's gone away and it's no longer providing an offset to the legs of the five-year swap.
Correct.
So you don't have 500 of principal to reloan, but what's happened is you now are down to a single pay fixed receive variable. So that, if you look at it in combination with your loan book, means that you've transformed 500 of the loan into variable rate.
Yep.
So at
the end of T3, assuming I don't do any other
right.
mitigating actions.
Before any mitigating actions.
The portfolio yeah. would be open, quote unquote, subject to risk at that point.
What you'd have is 500 would still be fixed and untouched, and 500 would be variable rate, considered in combination with the swap. Would be variable rate debt, so it would be exposed to interest rate changes for the next 2 years.
No more. No.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Okay.
That's but what it, you it, mean by the portfolio it, will be open to risk.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Ross, sorry, stupid question. If the cost or fair value of derivatives are not so significant amount,
Then why do we consider this
kind of initial recognition?
I said
at initial recognition.
Oh, after the subsequent change or loss.
Yeah.
So the largest derivative market in the world, it runs in a few trillions, yes. It can have significant fair value.
So that's the purpose of our hedge account.
You're talking about cost or fair value?
Fair value.
Yeah, in the beginning.
Okay, good question. I'm talking about at initial recognition, there's no fair value because swaps, that's how they're traded. But within the next day, it will pick up fair value. Okay? Next hour, it picks up fair value as soon as the market moves. Yes, excuse me.
All right, page 15. Okay. So in this example here, I've now assumed that after a very short period of time passes, the bank doubles its deposit size. It's able to bring in an extra $1,000 of deposits and immediately assesses them as zero rate perpetual funding. Appreciate this example is a bit unrealistic. The bank's funding base would not double overnight, and you would not assess deposits immediately as zero-rate funding, but let's just put that to the side for now. So when we add those deposits to the risk measurement process, what you're going to see is if you compare the old target profile with what I'm going to call the new target profile, the terms of the profile are no different. It's 50% three-year, 50% five-year. The old target profile was also 50% three-year, 50% five-year. It simply changes the notional of that profile. And so the origination of the new deposits simply kind of slots into the profile and adds to it. So from that perspective, it doesn't change the profile, it just increases the notional of that profile. We're going to start to talk throughout this presentation and as we go forward about changes in inputs versus a change in the profile. And so the amount of deposits that are available is really an input to this question rather than the actual profile, which is what management wants to do with those deposits.
But slide 15 is forgetting about the fact, doesn't seem to reflect the fact that we have 500 of variable rate for years 4 and 5, because it says you have 500 of five-year NIM, and so presumably that's the fixed rate NIM. Mm-hmm. But you also still have in years 4 and 5, 500 of variable rate, because that's the 1,000 that you had. It's the 500 for which the five-year fixed to floating mm-hmm. is open. So when you look at the target profile on 15, the top one, the old target profile, I'm not getting to the growth, I'm just getting to what you have. You have 500 that is presumably running exposed to floating rate that seems to have disappeared off the picture.
And so we can again, I go back to case study when we talked about last time, and I'm not doing a good job here, so I'll have to think
about it. No, you are. It's just hard to get back into it after a month.
I'll have to think about it. Well, my point is that the presentation is leading to this question, so I have to think about making this a gross presentation. Mm-hmm. So the point there is that when we said, okay, at the end of 3 years, we want a repricing action to take place. And so there's going to be an action at the end of year three which will address that residual float risk that you're talking about.
Okay.
It's not being shown here because it's a future action against a float exposure, and so I can show the future action against the float exposure, but then it's kind of a float versus float future, which is a gross presentation, but I'm just showing it net.
So I think it's old target profile has still $1,000 of loads.
Correct.
But what you have managed is to divide that in when that $1,000 repriced, mm-hmm. and half of that is repriced after 3 years, so your repricing risk is after 3 years, and the other half is after 5 years.
Put a different
so showing this.
In that example here, we can understand that you consciously took the decision to be exposed from year three for during 2 years to the interest rates.
You're not exposed for 2 years. You're exposed for what you think you're going to do with that point when it matures. So realistically, if you're saying I want 50% 3 year and 50% 5 year, most likely at the end of year three, you're going to reinvest to another 3 year asset.
Of course you are going, but the way you show in 14 is that it's often the decision up to the point where you are going in the end of year three, you are going to decide what you are going to do.
Daryl, you had a
I don't know, I was going to respond, but I think we probably got there.
Okay. So we grow the portfolio, it's now doubled in size, there's no change to the relative repricing percentages. Now I'm going to start to get into the cycle aspect of this. That, okay, what do I do with this $1,000 of funding that I've just received? In this example, I've assumed that they'll originate 500 of five-year loans and 500 of three-year loans. So now when I look at the asset profile I have, excluding derivatives for the time being, I've got 1,500 of five-year loans and then kind of 500 of five-year loans, 1,500 of five-year loans, and 500 of three-year loans. I compare that against the target profile, I have a misalignment here. So I want 50-50 and I have kind of a 75-25 split. So I have to update my risk comparison, update the inputs here, evaluate whether or not I'm against my profile or not, and make a decision based upon the update there. On slide 17, the mitigating actions that would be required are these same pay fix interest rate swaps and receive swaps that we've discussed previously. But I'm going to compare the required derivatives to align the profile against the actual derivatives I already have. In theory, I've actually moved forward one step in time, so I actually have historical mitigating actions. What you can see here is that I already have the derivatives I need, so there's no further mitigating action required. So from this perspective, again, you can start to see the cycle where you update your inputs, those go into a comparison, you compare the output of that comparison against the need for mitigating actions, and if I have to take a further action, I will do that.
Just again, checking and following you. So the reason that you concluded, another way of looking at this on slide 17 is when you step back and look at the total, you do not have to take any further mitigating action because with the growth, unlike the original portfolio, the growth originated loans with the split that you want. So when you add them in, you're already at the right place.
Correct.
And it's because the first time you originated all one duration and you wanted two durations the second time, as it happened, what you originated matched your profile.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Slide 19 walks through a similar example. But rather than funding the new loans with deposits, they've been funded by issued debt. So I've issued senior debt for some, because that's what I did. So from this perspective, the target profile here is now a little bit different in the sense that it's still the $1,000 of deposits split between the durations that I've set, but now I have this debt I have to think about as well. And so this is a point that we're going to talk about, the specificity of the profile. And so if you set your profile to say, I want 50% three-year assets and 50% five-year assets, that implies a certain profile, a certain mitigating action. If your profile is more along the lines of, I would like to align contractual repricing where possible, and when I have deposits, I want it to be this duration concept, that is a different profile. So you have to be very specific with what you actually intend your risk management objective to be. Because if you're relatively vague or you don't think about some of the growth that can occur, you can end up with an odd scenario at the end of the day that you weren't anticipating. And so you have to be forward-looking, thinking about what events could occur, and am I comfortable with those events, and how do I incorporate those into my profile today? The rest of the debt funded story here on page 20 just repeats the point that I would update my inputs, I would make a comparison. If there are mitigating actions required, I would do that. If I already have the derivatives in place to close the position, then I'm fine. So in Mary's example, from the previous one, there are no further mitigating actions required in this example because I issued debt for 5 years and I originated loans for 5 years, and so the durations are matching between those profiles. The subtle point that comes out here, which just to make sure people are following it, is that there's been no change in profile. Again, I just had a change in inputs, assuming I contemplated growth when I set up my profile. But NIM has changed. Forward-looking NIM is now different because the funding mix has changed. I went from a bank that had 100% deposits to 50% deposits. And deposits are, from a funding perspective, more profitable than debt. And so there will be a change in NIM going forward. And so from that perspective, NIM has obviously repriced. But it repriced because there was a change in input. Again, having an overnight change in your funding mix by 100% is not going to occur. But the ridiculousness of the example makes the point home there, that the dynamic aspect is reacting to these changes, and it's going to align the profile there. That's a different statement than saying nothing is ever going to make, NIM will never change in the future again. Those are two different statements to make. And so there's nothing that management could have done in this example other than refuse the loan and refuse the debt to avoid a change in NIM. If it is in the best interest of the institution to make that lending arrangement, it will do so. So it has to think about how NIM will be impacted by growth from that perspective. I was most worried about that slide.
Yes, I shared.
Thank you.
So slide 22 is a bit of a summary of the earlier conversations here about growth and maturity. That the dynamic aspect of DRM is really a bit of a cycle where you update inputs, the profiles, you compare the assets against the target, you identify mitigating actions that are required. If the mitigating actions have already been taken, then you're fine. If you need to take additional ones, then do it. It would be very common, I'm making this split where you say I'm going to look at the assets in the profile and then identify derivatives, compare derivatives to the ones I have, and then make a final decision. In practice, you'll just lump the derivatives in with the asset profile at the start and make that comparison, but that's just a mathematical exercise more than anything else. So that's the core aspect of dynamic about the changing nature of the portfolio, the cycle that's constantly repeated, and the reacting nature of it.
I think what's also special about the fact that this is such a continuous process. So, you know, if this happened every 6 months or something, then it would be changing, but it wouldn't be so dynamic in the sense that it's not so constant, because one of the challenges the banks have focusing on them is the fact that it's just changing so constantly that the old style sort of onesie twosie hedge accounting just isn't really that great in an environment where there's so much change to deal with.
When you talk about banks in particular that have in the banking book, you've got very, very large balance sheets comprised of arguably immaterial individual components from the individual loans. The number of certs becomes enormous, and the fact that these things operate daily, then the change that happens day over day from a certificate perspective can be impressive. And so something, again, at the end of the day, it's a cycle as any other business cycle is. Yeah. It's just got a lot of volume that goes through it, and it's very short.
Just quickly, Sue has preempted what we were planning to come to. One of the reasons we are going through this process is, I think, the challenges which we need to tackle is the dynamic nature. And as I don't know if you'll remember, a while back Steve had mentioned we need to separate the two. What is the challenge coming because of the portfolio is changing rapidly? This is the cause of the rapidly changing portfolio, and the solution to that is slightly different because, as Sue mentioned, the challenge with this is not actually the hedging or anything, it's the designation and the rapid. There's also a measurement issue that comes up because it's not just the documentation. So if you're doing a fair value hedge, you will have a fair value hedge adjustment. So every time you designate and de-designate, you have a new amortization pattern coming up. So the challenges that come from the dynamic nature and how we approach that will be different when we start looking at how we look at what is the asset profile and how do you manage that and how do we reflect that. So that's one of the key parts which we wanted to get through from this session, is that this is the challenge that comes from the D of DRM. And that's more operational and coming up with designation, de-designation, and how banks do it and why, as Sue said, the complaints we get.
Can I ask a question about that's essentially how D is D? And what I mean by that is, you know, Ross, thinking about your experience, is it in a large bank, you know, not large, not necessarily top five, but, you know, large bank, not necessarily yours, just what you know, is this something that's being done every night, seeing, you know, how the asset portfolio has changed? Is it being done every week? And how many you know, what we're going through very simply, and you say, okay, it's unrealistic that it's going to change double in size overnight. I agree, and I'm all for simplicity in these examples. But what kind of reassessment are you talking about going through this five-step cycle?
So the fastest I've seen it is 4 times daily, which was that particular cut of the book. Pricing was updated 4 times daily, and so the risk capture process was run 4 times daily to make sure you were capturing.
Would they respond every time with mitigating action?
Yes, if required.
Right, but you'd go through the cycle of steps 4 times a day.
That was the fastest I've seen it. I would say that is not common. Daily is common. People will run this every night, and they.
So you spend Tuesday rebalancing what happened Monday?
Correct. First thing Tuesday morning, you'd close the position at effectively end of day Monday. So you're doing this daily, but on a one-day lag. There are some products that are computationally intensive to measure. So when you get into option products, which I promise I do not use the P words, valuing a very large portfolio of fully open mortgages, running that overnight is computationally difficult, and so you need three days or so to actually value the position, and so that's a constraint, that it can only be hedged every 3 days, and you can only measure it every 3 days. But I would say it's common for it to be done frequently. I would say, so that's between a day to a week, but that is my experience.
Okay.
I cannot speak for all jurisdictions.
I've seen day cycles, yeah.
Thanks. Martin.
Only short question. Is there hedge designations, or the hedge accounting guys who are sitting there in the back office and following what risk managers are doing, is this designation of then the derivatives to individual assets or liabilities, is that also done on a daily basis if the management changing daily, or is that done maybe once a quarter or once a month? Or
it depends.
It very much depends. I have seen organizations update their designations daily. I've seen organizations update their designations weekly, even though the risk measurement is daily. And so it very much depends on the institution.
I know of departments, Martin, especially if you're doing option hedging, because previously you couldn't do time value, which had to be done daily to get your effectiveness right.
Yeah.
So we have teams doing it every day. The other thing is using the term, it depends, usually will at the bank will say, will depend on the volatility appetite of the head of the desk, how much volatility in P&L he or she is willing to accept. And that will drive how much designation you do.
I would also add to Kumar's comments there, depending upon the quality of the designation, that certain designations are made because they will last a week, but they will not last a month from an effectiveness perspective. Mm-hmm. So those are rebalanced very quickly.
That's the option bit.
Yeah. And I have another question. In some of your examples, when you, for example, have your target profile where you have already a 5-year fixed loan, which is then funded by core demand deposits, which in all your examples have then in higher interest rates, these loans, and then you are changing your target profile, and in your examples then to 500 in 3 years and 500 remaining to 1 year, but with the effect that the net interest margin goes down. And I'm always wondering with these examples, because when I would be in the bank and I would like to have more 5.5% margin instead of, I don't know, 3.5% margin. And you're all doing that because you want to manage your repricing risk. Can you a little bit explain why is that irrational behavior?
You're assuming banks are rational.
No, but if you took only this example, it's difficult to understand. Why is it
so? Very good question. Looking forward to the answer.
So yes, organization. I'll answer it in a risk management sentence first, which then I'll translate this. Organizations will reduce duration of their loan book, meaning they will reduce the NIM that they're going to earn from the combination of their loans and their derivatives, and they'll do that because the longer a loan exists, the longer the period of time for rates to change on that loan. And so the longer period of time you're exposed to, the risk of that loan will now become a significantly off-market loan. By that I mean, if I'm expecting to earn 6.5% in my example, if markets rate were to jump to 10%, I have to wait 5 years to participate in that repricing. And so there is a trade-off between what is the correct level of profit for the shareholders given the environment versus what is the opportunity cost of being able to participate in market changes going forward. If I were an organization, I'm looking at Tom because he and I share a jurisdictional background. So if you were...
Same problems?
Yeah. Well...
Because that is...
I've lived in almost every province, so it covers...
But so in Canada in the 80s, you had interest rates 20-25%. So if I had a 30-year loan originated in the 80s, and I'm the bank, I'm going to earn 25% for 30 years. Interest rates have done nothing but fall since that time. So that's a very profitable trade. So that would have been great to lock it in at that point. But rates could have gone the other way. And if rates have gone up, then I've now not been able to participate in that change in rates for 30 years. So that is the trade-off as to how quickly do you want to
react. You don't change the duration of the loan, you change the duration of the fixed interest period.
Correct. So that's the trade-off that is made. And yes, sometimes institutions will take NIM off the table to manage this opportunity cost or the price.
I understand that for a 30-year loan. And then perhaps that's most of the portfolio of mortgages. For a 5-year loan, already becoming more questionable. This is the example, but is it in practice, are we talking about long duration?
If you accept the 30-year example, then you've accepted the theory. And then it becomes the question about calibrating the equation.
I think there are probably two things in practice, too. I think possibly, clearly the shorter the loan, the less expensive it is to actually cover this, to provide this sort of cover normally. And I suspect some of your numbers here might be exaggerated for effect. The gaps are not likely to be as big as they are.
Sure.
But my experience also was that the risk committees often set these criteria and kind of said you need to do it, because what they didn't want you doing is speculating whether you were at the top of the cycle or the bottom of the cycle, because that then meant you were getting into a speculative type trade.
Correct.
When I asked that question, because it is not, I think, understand that is one key element of that is stabilizing the net interest margin. It's not for a certain period optimizing the net NIM. It's stabilizing over time for that you don't have really kind of big hits, because if you have a big hit then in 1 year and then you are really in trouble. And that is that you're giving up margin to stabilizing that.
Just one comment on the duration, because we are, of course, we tend to think about Europe and then how interest rates have been somewhat stabilized in the last 8 years or so. But if you look for markets, the other side of the Atlantic is 5 years is considered, can be considered long term, because interest rate changed quite a lot. So when we think that, I think that the accepting the theory means that this could be applied also in other areas where the volatility of interest rates are bigger in shorter periods of time.
And my question was, how frequently is the target profile revised, and at what level in the governance of the entity is that decision made?
So we can talk about, we have not talked about changes in the target profile so far. We've talked about changes in the inputs. So I just want to make sure there's a clear delineation between a change in the inputs and a change in the profile. And I think it's fair to comment that an institution will change its profile from time to time. If you set a profile once and the institution lasts for 50 years, business factors change and you should revisit that. So organizations change their profiles infrequently. For the common comments that Daryl was making is that there is a strong governance oversight as to the decision makers of the profile that sometimes will go up to the risk committee of the board. And so it's not even a management decision, it is a board decision. That is one example. And so just comment that that is the governance that exists for every institution. I can't make that claim. But generally speaking, the regulators are, provincial regulators are very interested in these profiles. They take it very seriously. If you're going to change it, that's fine. There must be appropriate approvals of that change. There must be a reason for that change, and it must be well documented. And in certain jurisdictions, they say, that's nice. For the next 3 years, you must measure yourself against your new profile and against the old one, and I want to understand what you're doing about the differences. So they take the a change in a profile is taken very seriously.
Not to disagree with you, but I think that certainly the practice that I've seen is that the risk committee sets a band, which is a fairly narrow band, but then management has the prerogative to operate within that band. So it does mean that the profile changes, but it's incrementally much smaller there. And then I think so the band set by your risk committee is likely to change very seldom. But you're operating within the band can sometimes change in reaction to market events.
When we were looking at this, one of the things when the last DRM came up was how much you look at trading books and limits and other things. I think I'll go just amplify a little bit what Daryl said. You will have an overall target, which changes very rarely because it's hard cast, and getting to the board risk committee to get them to approve it again and again, it's just not feasible. But how broad that band is and how much latitude that profile gives to individual departments to trade within that. For example, how much of, as Mary was saying, how much of that five-year open position they have to close after 5 years, and that does vary significantly from the time. So it depends upon what is the strategy and everything on the latitude that operationally you will have to be within that band, i.e. how broad that band can be.
Mary?
How formal is the reporting process on actual versus target profile, you know, within the institution and then by the prudential regulators? You know, an entity may have budgets, and yes, management is interested in are you plus or minus budget, but what you've just described sounds like, subject to the bands, that there would be presumably very explicit reporting of whether you achieved your duration profile. And, you know, almost transaction by transaction, or
so it wouldn't be transaction by transaction, just because of the volume of transactions.
Yeah. But, sorry, transaction, but I mean, I think about, sorry, this is a very different scenario, but it's our world. We have an operating procedure that all papers for a meeting are posted by, you know, X number of days before the meeting, and those that aren't are reported. So, you know, so they're subject to oversight on an exception basis. Is that the kind of approach that's here, you know, here's your profile?
Isn't it going to depend on the bank and their governance and okay. the regulator and everything else?
Yeah, it very much does depend on the bank. And I don't want to say sophistication is not the right word. It generally depends on the size of the bank, to be perfectly frank. The larger the bank relative to the economy and the jurisdiction in which they operate, the regulator will force an increased quality of reporting on that. So I have seen institutions where there is, again, daily measurement, daily reporting against this band. If you're not in the band, there are consequences for being outside of the band, and you don't want to have those consequences. Whereas I've seen smaller institutions where they update their risk measurement monthly, and then the CEO and the CFO talk about it. So it very much does vary.
Okay.
I think fundamentally, the key factor is the market economy itself, rather than your normal formula there.
The prudential regulator does play a large part, I would say.
It depends, again, on which jurisdiction you are and where you are. It's not that everywhere prudential regulators will. Yep. This is the example, maybe if you remember initially, it said some of the reconciliations which you do when you do that, the frequency, the accuracy, and what action comes out of that will vary quite a bit.
Okay.
Ms. Chow on governance. Okay. On so moving on to the last event we'll discuss today is time. And so time isn't really an event, but again, I'm going to make the point about specificity of the profile, and if you're not really specific, how you could get yourself in an unintentional place. And so I've reused the example from slide 13 where I've got my target profile of 50% 3 year, 50% 5 year, some loans which have been transformed by a period of derivatives. So management has said I want 50% repricing after 3 years and 50% repricing after 5 years. On slide 25, I'm going to move forward a year in time now. So I put this red line here in the middle, and I moved the now piece away from the start. So now everything has 4 years left to it, 4 years or 2 years, rather than the 5 years and 3 years. So now there's a question to be asked as to, is this aging of the portfolio what management intended? So now I'm going to have 50% repricing in 2 years and 50% in 4 years. That might be the correct interpretation, because management might say, well, I said I want it in 3 years, and so that's what's occurring. I'm just moving one step forward in time. But did management mean that, or did they mean I want repricing to take place to be fixed at kind of now plus 3 years? And so that's a subtle difference, but those are very important deltas that can mean things. And so this becomes easier to understand if I switch to variables and to get back into equations. So on slide 26, I've kind of set up this table breaking it out into the time buckets, which will start to mirror some of the risk reports you would see in practice. And I've got my variables here of time, T notional of NTN, and then the percentage symbol of repricing percentage in that period. And so if I wanted 50% 3 year, 50% 5 year, I would slot my 50% related to that notional into T3 and into T5. So I would read this profile saying, yep, 50% in T3, 50% in T5. In slide 27, I move forward a year in time. So I kind of shift my table down and to the right. Now becomes T1, I have no longer T0. T3 is still the same number. It's still 3 year, it's still three periods after T0. And so there's no change in when the repricing is going to occur. So the pricing of the aging of the portfolio has occurred, perhaps as you might initially interpret that profile. But slide 28 highlights the point there that if really how it was defined is that T0 is defined as T now, and the profile is defined as T now plus something, and as I move towards T1, T1 plus 3 is equal to T4. And so the repricing is no longer going to take place at the end of T3. It's not going to take place at the end of T4. Those are different periods in time, and the profile no longer matches up with it. I have my actual profile here, which show T3 and T5, not T4 and T6. So mitigating actions would be required to align that portfolio. So I'm not saying that people would ever do this type of, I always want repricing to take place 3 years from now. This is perhaps an odd profile. But the point there is about specificity. If you're not specific about how the profile behaves and reacts to maturity and growth and time, then you're going to have your profile potentially doing odd things on you. And that could lead to strange mitigating actions, which makes the story very difficult to tell to everybody there, and will lead to significant rebalancing of derivatives. So the point there on slide 29, which is the overall conclusion, is just that when you're thinking about the dynamic nature of the portfolio, given it's a lot of change, given it's a lot of transactions, given it's a cycle that updates daily, when you're setting your profile and thinking about your risk management, you should think about the events that can impact that, make sure you ensure your profile recognizes that, and define it such that you can track your performance against it. The more specific you are, the easier that is to do, and the easier it is to tell the story about how well you've done. If you're relatively vague, it's very difficult to understand what you are trying to accomplish, and potentially even very difficult to understand the risk position you've got yourself into at that point in time.
And presumably that means also has implications for us, in the sense that depending on the level of specificity and the way that it's established by management, it will change the parameters we would have to work with prima facie for any sort of reporting in terms of the success, for want of, to choose a neutral word, of the hedging strategy.
Yeah. To evaluate success or failure, you must have something to compare it against. And if it's not, if your benchmark isn't specific, that becomes very difficult to compare.
I think one of the things, if my memory serves me well, you might remember, Kumar, that we touched on in the previous discussion paper was about whether the fact that management was more or less specific in their targets would have a consequence for
whether you defined your portfolios.
Well, also, do you look more successful just by being more vague with what you said you'd do?
Yes.
And whether there's sort of unintended consequences in that. So there's an interrelationship that's important for us.
Yeah. Just to add on, and I think for someone wants to come in, one of the reasons, as I said, two reasons. One, we want for the session is think of the dynamic nature that's got a different kind of problem set. But I think you all would have guessed by now, one of the key things which we'll be looking at is this asset profile. and how that works, because that's how, without going into success failure, but that is one of the key objectives. What DRM is trying to do is come to an asset profile which gives you a particular type of name. The other second objective, as we were talking about, as Sue mentioned, is that you need to be pretty specific, because there are a number of variables that are changing, and that's why we broke down the discussion, or as we go between what is the profile and what are the inputs to that profile and how that impacts, because it will have an implication as we go forward and try and capture what the RM is trying to do, because that's based on the profile. And when we look at the definition, as Ross said, if the time is a good one, because it's something that people, we tend to miss, but this is a real income, a fixed income portfolio, and time is critical. So you have to have that level of specificity, otherwise just becoming a vague, you can be successful, because all that you have done is you have had the march of time, but things haven't worked out as you want. So these are the two key objectives that we were trying to get to. I'll come to the next bit later, Hans.
Tom, yeah.
On these two things you just showed us, the kind of moving versus the, I guess, stagnant one, it strikes me that in practice they must do some kind of a hybrid of these two things. Like, can you just talk, like, how do they actually run these things in reality?
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, so...
Well, this idea, like, you know, you have the point in time looking out, we rebalance at year three, or, you know, and then year three becomes year two. So it seems to me that in actually managing this, you actually probably need both those things you showed us on whatever those slides were.
Part of the portfolio you would keep at three and five, and others you will just let age.
Presumably you don't wait to the, if you want to always have 3 years, presumably you don't wait to the end of the year until you rebalance it. I think that's what.
Yeah.
How often is this done? Yes.
Yeah, it's just kind of generically, how do you shift between the, it sounds to me like they're constantly keeping an eye on both almost.
Effectively, yes. Yeah. The risk measurements are always done on a forward-looking basis, saying what's going to happen today and what's going to happen in the future. So there's kind of a grid to those risk reports there. And very much those reports are focused on all aspects of the scope, which is generally the entire banking book. So they are aware, in this example, at the end of year three, that something will occur. The question in the risk report is, they'll say, is that event that will occur in year three, Will that cause a problem for me in year three, or will it not cause a problem for me in year three versus my objective? And that question is built into the risk measurement. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Can I see if we're asking? We have broken it up into time, maturity, and other things. Are you asking that, are these done separately, or is it done together?
I'm just making sure. I'm assuming it's done, if not together, at least reciprocally, that you're constantly looking at both. I just wanted to make sure.
Absolutely.
I understood this right.
Without getting into it, since Ross introduced the equations, these are multivariate equations. They will be updated. All the variables will be looked at every snapshot in time to see how that, and the correlations and the interrelations between them.
Yeah, my question was relative to the slide 29. And so I've understood why it's important to be specific, but I've understood it from a risk management perspective. If you really want to deliver what you intended to deliver, then you better
know what you're doing.
Yeah, describe that precisely enough so that it can be met accordingly. But then I wondered, with the title of the slide that you titled Accounting Model Relevance, and I thought, well, where is the relevance to accounting?
So it's probably a poorly titled slide.
More than anything else.
It was just a way to try and bring, which was very much a risk in a governance conversation, to say, okay, well, why is that relevant to a conversation of what is going to be the accounting model to reflect these activities in the financial statement? So it was my attempt to say, okay, what from a standard center perspective should we be drawing specifically from this? My attempt to offer suggestions as to that.
Absolutely fair point. So we haven't told you what the relevance for the accounting other than give you the indication where slowly we're coming to is that the asset profile will play a significant role in whatever model we look at, and therefore so will the specificity of the profile.
My next question is, in fact, in the practice you've had, have you seen variations from one bank to the other as to how specific the target profile was defined, and are there mistakes in that?
So I wouldn't go to say mistakes. I would say I have seen different levels of specificity.
Yes, quite a bit.
So, again, I would say it correlates relatively well with the size of the organization. So.
If I'm allowed to a follow-up question, would the way a target profile is defined be considered by a bank as part of his intellectual property?
When you say intellectual property, I mean, are you saying is it proprietary information?
More like as a competitive advantage.
Yeah, proprietary information. Could be. Yes, very well.
I think Françoise asks a good question because, in a sense, I sort of preempted something we haven't actually decided, because I'm sort of guessing that information about how successful the bank is in achieving its strategy would be interesting information to people, but yeah, we haven't actually decided that yet. But I think it's something, whatever we do, I think thinking about the relationship between the information provided and what's interesting information, relevant information, and this will be important.
Yes.
What might be worth saying just to Francois's question, though, is that when we did the first DP on DRM, and we went around to different jurisdictions, what you found is a lot of commonality of thinking in a jurisdiction, but not across jurisdictions. And I think that represented the fact that there'd been some exchange of staff over time in those areas. So that sort of picked up
the
influence of a regulator.
Very important, depending upon how tough the regulator is and what the new language you do.
Also, the types of products in different markets, too, presumably.
Yeah. There's quite a bit.
I would come to Daryl's point. Within the jurisdictions, you'll often find the hedge counterparty is just one of your competitors. And so since you're constantly going to them, if you have a stable profile, you're constantly going to them for the same type of derivative. It's relatively easy to figure out what someone is doing. So from that perspective, it's perhaps less sensitive than you might think, but it's still, I would say, yes, some people are quite sensitive to what their profile is. So.
Russ, had you come to the end, or yes?
Yes. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
A couple of comments, Hans?
Yes?
Just quickly, so that I know we will run out of patience with the board very soon. What we are trying to do is build up. We will certainly have to look at prepayments in due course, not immediately, because that is one of the key drivers, what happens. The other thing which we plan to bring in is basically, although we have spoken about banking and everything, what we do want to establish and talk about the same process in terms of a generic company which is doing foreign exchange and where the commonalities are between what a bank is trying to do and what is done by any other corporate, because that helps us draw out, hopefully, some of the principles that we can use when we look at building a solution to see what is there on the other side.
Those commonalities on the D thing, or are they elsewhere?
Elsewhere. The dynamic nature is pretty unique to this bit. That's why we split it up.
Why is dynamic unique to this? I mean,
because
surely there's similar dynamic things happening in...
Not with this frequency. I've never seen it with this kind of frequency with any other organization outside the financial services world. So let's say if I look at commodities or foreign exchange for any other corporate, it's not updated daily, or it's not updated. Maybe it'll be updated once a month.
So the risk management is different.
Yes. The concepts of the risk management is, when we'll come to that, maybe I should have kept quiet. It is still a net position NIM management in a way, but it doesn't have this level of frequency of updating and other things. It doesn't happen. They don't need to. They don't have these constant volume of transactions. They know they have long-term contracts, so their planning is much more stable.
Is that true, though? So say you're, I don't know, hedging oil price risk or something, and you're doing lots of transactions, could you not similarly have lots of things going on all at once?
It is possible, but mostly those are from trading desks. I've never seen it in a hedging desk, which is a refiner I'm talking about. So if you have a refining product, you have a very good idea of how much is going to go out of your refinery. You can't overnight turn the refinery tonnage from 1 million to 2 million. So those are much more stable. It is done once a month, depending upon production and commodities, but never with this level.
So the one-to-one designation isn't a problem outside banking?
I haven't heard that, and that was also reconfirmed very specifically.
And insurance, presumably.
I'm not talking about insurance. I don't know. I'm not talking about insurance, but in commodity and other space, that fact was specifically confirmed when we did the DP, where people said, with given the changes that have been brought in by nine, we are comfortable, we can manage.
But if this is not an issue outside financial services...
I didn't say it's not an issue. I said the dynamic nature is not that big a problem.
Okay. And obviously, I don't understand what is a problem. You'll reveal...
It will all be revealed in due course. That's why I'm saying maybe I should have opened my... I'm opening my mouth a bit too early. We'll make sure it's revealed to you as well before you go.
Mary?
Well, just on this
final comment.
If we look at different industries, you know, move away from financial institutions, I may be jumping ahead a bit, but it was interesting to start to get a perspective on how tightly this is managed as a process and what kind of reporting, what kind of internal discipline there is. And I think if we start to look at other industries, you may be talking about different frequency because different type of risk, but I think it would also start to be interesting
to see what the process
is. To see if there's comparable, you know, scale down or not process. Yeah. I'm guessing that with the whole prudential regulatory system over certain types of institutions that it may not be entirely absent, but it's of a very different nature.
Yeah.
So that may be another thing to think about in terms of similarities and
so
differences.
So that people don't read more into our comments than they should or shouldn't. We're not planning at this point that we're saying that any particular industry
right.
is not allowed to use what we're developing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are looking at fixed income or we are talking about interest rate risk at the moment. It's not.
We have decided to focus now on interest rate risk management
that's
in banks, and if we have understood that, then we'll do the next. I think that we have decided...
We focused on, we agreed.